But I'm grateful to the sources within those teams who spoke for this reporting, and to the cases in which the companies in question, Microsoft or Meta, for instance, agreed to participate even in the film. You know, we have people going on camera talking about how they do this. I think more openness about this is called for, and that people should celebrate the cases in which companies put resources into protecting their customers in this way. There's not enough, but there is some going on, and that does deserve acknowledgement.
Pulitzer Prize-winning journalists Ronan Farrow and Matthew O'Neill talking about their new documentary, Surveilled. It's streaming on Max. The film looks at the activity of spyware companies, including the Israeli firm NSO, which makes the spyware program Pegasus. The film is directed by Perry Peltz, Matthew O'Neill, and produced by Ronan Farrow. Ronan won the Pulitzer for exposing Harvey Weinstein's history of sexual abuse. The Hollywood mogul paid the Israeli private intelligence firm Black Cube to suppress Ronan Farrow's reporting. We'll link to Farrow's New Yorker article, The Technology the Trump Administration Could Use to Hack Your Phone. Go to democracynow.org to see part one of our discussion. Happy birthday to Igor Moreno. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
Tuned into KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming on the web at kboo.fm.
Don't know what to get your loved ones this season? Check out kboo.fm/merch to snag some KBOO swag to support community media in style. While you're shopping for gifts, you can make donations to help support KBOO's $75,000 goal for our Catalog of Connections year-end campaign, now through December 21st. And thank you.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. KBOO's Community Advisory Board will meet on Monday, December 9th at 6 p.m. The meeting will be held at 20 South East 8th Avenue in Portland and online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting virtually can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on this end-of-year membership drive special of the KBOO Evening News, a tsunami scare in Oregon ends after an earthquake strikes off the coast of California, new help is on the way for wildfire survivors in Oregon, and fighting the war on obesity, will the government get more involved? Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, December 5th, 2024. KBOO is currently in our end-of-year membership drive, and we'd like to urge you to become a member by going online to kboo.fm/give. I'm Minette Newell. Thanks so much for joining us tonight. A tsunami warning is now canceled for the coastal areas of Oregon and California. Earlier this afternoon, the warning was posted after a 7.0 magnitude earthquake shook off the Northern California coast. Police in Berkeley, California had issued an evacuation order for parts of that city, but they lifted it after the tsunami warning was canceled. Shake alerts were delivered as far north as Lincoln City, Oregon, and as far south as Salinas, California. About 500,000 people received the alerts. There are no detailed reports on damage or landslides. With a rare unanimous vote, the U.S. Senate has passed a new measure granting tax relief for wildfire victim settlements. Oregon U.S. Senator Ron Wyden says he's worked on this bipartisan effort for months.
The families feel like They've been hit by a wrecking ball. And after getting clobbered, they're saying to themselves, why can't I get a fair shake from the government? Why are they hitting me again, even though I don't have any income? These are people who have truly been visited by a disaster. Their homes and their businesses are burned, their possessions and livelihoods gone. And finally, the federal government is showing some common sense. That's what my friend from California has spelled out. Our effort is going to lift a big tax burden that has hit these victims of wildfires and other natural disasters at exactly the worst time. We are getting rid of a totally unfair tax on legal fees associated with settlements after disasters. And by the way, we've been working in a bipartisan fashion, and we've had to do that because we're fixing something that went haywire in the 2017 tax bill. We have been pushing our colleagues in a bipartisan way for months to do a bill that addresses this and other issues. I see in the chair another very valuable member of the Finance Committee, our friend from New Hampshire, Senator Hassan. And she and I and others had a bill that got 357 votes in the House of Representatives that included this important legislation that Senator Padilla and Senator Cassidy and I have worked on. I say to my friend in California, we had our 1,100th town hall meeting where the victims came and said, Ron, is it ever going to get done? And I said, you bet it's going to get done. It's going to get done in the lame duck session. And they said, why hasn't it happened earlier? And the reality is, it should have happened earlier, because when you get 357 votes in the House of Representatives, which included our bill, you don't get 357 votes very often over there in the House of Representatives. It doesn't happen by osmosis. It's because my colleagues here work in a bipartisan way and wanted to get this done. So we wanted, frankly, to do more. We wanted to do it earlier, but I say to my colleagues that we're going to keep going on the things from that package that got 357 votes in the House. But tonight is an evening when Senator Padilla and I have said, after all this waiting, we're going to see these people who've been clobbered by these huge infernos, because that's the only way to describe our fires, I think, Senator Padilla. These are infernos. It gets hot and dry on the forest floor. Somebody drops a match. Maybe there's a lightning strike. Kaboom! Those people are finally, through the work that's been done by my friend from California, our friend from Louisiana, and Senator Schatz, and we're going to be able to tell folks in the West, in California and Oregon, the Westerners who've been hit by these big fires, they're going to be able to go to bed in the Western United States with a little relief that the federal government has finally come to its senses and made sure that they're not going to have this additional tax burden. So I want to thank my friend from California for his good work. This is a good night for the people that we represent in the West. We're finally getting justice and a fair shake for people who did nothing wrong but have been visited by these fires.
And that was Oregon U.S. Senator Ron Wyden. And as he mentioned, California Senator Alex Padilla was also involved in this effort.
We just passed a significant disaster tax bill, which is critical to helping disaster survivors across the country. And it includes bipartisan legislation that I introduced along with Senator Wyden, would make sure that individuals, families, and entire communities who have suffered from utility-caused wildfires can receive the full compensation to rebuild their lives without fear that their settlement payments will be subject to taxes. In my home state of California, over 70,000 people have been impacted by the destruction of the Butte Fire, the North Bay Fire, and the Camp Fire in recent years. Now, if you can imagine when you are wading through the ashes of your former home and thinking about how you can possibly begin to rebuild. The last thing you should have to worry about is that the government is going to tax the payment from your legal settlement that already fails to cover the full cost of your losses in the first place. Disaster settlement funds aren't income. It's not an asset. It's compensation for what a family has lost. It's meant to be an opportunity to begin to rebuild your life, an opportunity that should not be diminished because our tax code is outdated. Utility-caused fires are becoming increasingly common across the western United States. This bill that we just passed would make sure that all recent and future wildfire victims throughout the country have access to their full settlements. That includes those in Oregon and Hawaii who have either reached settlements or are still working through the process with the utilities that caused devastating wildfires. I want to thank Senator Cassidy and Senator Wyden for their partnership, and I look forward to seeing the president sign this bill into law.
And that was California U.S. Senator Alex Padilla. Rural Oregon has been using the same approach to fight wildfires for 100 years, but Julia Tilden reports climate change is causing some local firefighters to worry about their ability to fight future fires.
Oregon's mega drought means conditions are drier now than any time in the past 1,000 years. Douglas County District Fire Warden Patrick Scripp says he's seen how fires have grown bigger and more intense during his decades-long career.
In this era of fire, we've seen more acres burned in our district in the last 10 years than in the last 100 years combined.
Timber cutting is a huge part of industry in Southwest Oregon. Coos Forest Protective Association District Manager Tyler McCarty says private landowners have worked hand in hand with local firefighters for a century to keep their forests and economy protected. But now he says their resources are strained.
We're operating a system and a funding model that doesn't support the fires that we're seeing today.
Changing wildfire seasons are among the causes for the endangered status of the greater sage-grouse population in western states, including Oregon, Washington, and Wyoming. Kathleen Shannon has more on the story.
Final federal plans for greater sage-grouse habitat in western states were met with criticism last month, but some say the overdue plans need to be passed. The final environmental impact statement from the U.S. Department of the Interior revises policies on nearly half of sage-grouse habitat across 10 states. Some environmental advocates say the plans aren't protective enough for the birds, whose populations have declined about 80% across their range since the mid-1960s. But Allison Holleran with Audubon Rockies says work needs to be able to happen on the ground now.
We have wasted 10 years. We have serious issues with climate and drought, in invasive species, wildfire eating up our sagebrush. These plans have an ability to put our words into action, finally.
Current management is based on Obama-era 2015 plans, which the first Trump administration attempted to replace in 2019 in favor of its energy dominance agenda. Holleran says no one is sure what Trump's second term could mean for the new plans. The protest period ends December 16th. Wyoming Governor Mark Gordon wrote that the federal plans reflect extreme indifference to the primacy vested in Wyoming's exclusive authority to manage the bird's population and that he's hopeful about Trump's next term. Holleran says the Bureau of Land Management used the newest science, which has advanced since the 2015 plans, and that the agency is charged with balancing different kinds of land use.
I would say they are fair plans in taking what BLM lands are as multiple use. It is about how we all use our public lands. And I think the American people need to understand that as well.
The final impact statement reduces the acres of critical concern from its last proposed plans by nearly 25% to about 630,000 acres. But it also suggests tightening restrictions in those areas for oil and gas and wind and solar development. I'm Kathleen Shannon.
Social justice advocacy groups in Oregon are working together to enshrine more protections for vulnerable groups in the face of a second Trump administration. Some of that's preparing legal challenges to Trump's policies, but some of it is also creating legislation in Oregon, too. The American Civil Liberties Union of Oregon will lead a ballot measure campaign in 2026, trying to enshrine a number of rights under attack from conservatives into the Oregon Constitution. These include the right to abortion and reproductive health care, the right to trans and gender-affirming health care, and the right to same-sex marriage. Sandy Chung is the executive director of the ACLU of Oregon. She said, quote, "We've been preparing for the potential of a second Trump presidency for the last 4 years. Under a Trump presidency, as well as under the current Supreme Court that has six regressive Supreme Court justices, we can't take anything for granted. The strongest way of setting foundational rights is through our state constitution, end of quote. They're working with the Oregon Farm Worker Advocacy Group, PICUN, and others to create the Oregon for All Coalition. This coalition intends to defend the rights of immigrants in Oregon. Oregon's 2021 Sanctuary Promise Act prohibits government and law enforcement agencies from helping federal immigration enforcement without a warrant from a judge. If someone is targeted by police or ICE in violation of this law, people can report it anonymously to the Oregon Department of Justice at the hotline 1-844-924-STAY. Or visit the website sanctuarypromise.oregon.gov. Trump is reportedly considering changing his defense secretary nominee. The French prime minister is ousted. South Korea rejects martial law. Montana blocks a trans bathroom ban. And women's representation in state legislatures hits a new high. With more on the stories impacting our democracy, here's today's edition of 2024 Talks.
They say, unless you make a statement, we will publish it as is. And I think that's a despicable way to treat anyone.
Penelope Hegseth, the mother of President-elect Donald Trump's pick to lead the Defense Department, is criticizing the New York Times for publishing an email she sent her son. The email harshly criticized Fox News host Pete Hegseth for abuse and mistreatment of women. She says she wrote it during his difficult divorce and she now supports his nomination. Hegseth is meeting with senators, but the Washington Post reports Trump is considering replacing him as new charges of sexual misconduct come to light. Roger Wicker is a Mississippi Republican.
There are questions that some members have. We're going to be working for an answer.
Police are searching for the gunman who fatally shot United Healthcare CEO Brian Thompson outside a busy Manhattan hotel. The suspect fled north toward Central Park on a bike. Authorities are describing it as a carefully planned targeted killing. Chase Strangio made history as the first transgender attorney to argue before the Supreme Court. He's representing a teen denied testosterone treatment by a Tennessee law.
A transgender adolescent boy cannot receive testosterone because he was assigned female at birth. Had he been assigned male at birth, he could receive that same medication. That is sex discrimination.
A strong bipartisan majority of Montana lawmakers rejected a proposal to make trans individuals use the Capitol bathroom matching their gender at birth. Opponents say the rule was written to target the state's first transgender legislator. The number of women elected to state legislators will reach a record one-third of all seats next year. Jean Sinzdak is with the Center for American Women.
We need to see bigger jumps in terms of the numbers of women running and getting elected in order to get closer to parity. We're certainly making progress, but there's a ways to go.
French Prime Minister Michel Barnier was ousted by a no-confidence vote, making his government the shortest-lived in recent history. Far-right and left-wing legislators united to remove Barnier, deepening political challenges for President Emmanuel Macron. In South Korea, the president has been forced to almost immediately lift his declaration of martial law. Citizens rallied to preserve their democracy less than 40 years after the end of military dictatorship there. Lawmakers from both the president's party and the opposition voted against the declaration. Vice President Kamala Harris's historic campaign loss is moving some to ask if sexism and racism contributed to her defeat. Latasha Brown with the Black Voters Matter Fund argues Harris's identity was both a challenge and a source of inspiration.
We cannot also accept this idea that because she was a woman and she was Black, that in fact was a scarlet letter for her. In fact, part of the reason why he attacked it because it was a superpower as well.
I'm Farah Siddiqui.
You are listening to an end-of-year membership drive special on the KBOO Evening News. Our goal is to raise $75,000 by December 31st. We'd like to remind you that you can renew your KBOO membership or become a member at any time during this program by going online to kboo.fm/give. Stay tuned after this newscast for the Global Citizen International Digest with Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertoff. Then we'll speak with Laura Grimes from Oregon Arts Watch about the latest art stories from all around the state. At 6, it's Rose City Native Radio. Then at 7, American Indian Airwaves. Tonight's weather will be clear to partly cloudy, down to 34. Tomorrow, we'll see intervals of clouds and sun, a high of 47. Today in history, on this date in 1933, the 21st Amendment to the U.S. Constitution was ratified, ending prohibition in the U.S. Our quote of the day is from Imam Ali. two things define you: your patience when you have nothing, and your attitude when you have everything. In our KBOO News Health Beat report tonight, taking on the greed of the big food companies. That was the theme of a U.S. Senate hearing today. Leading the discussion was Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders.
In America, it is no secret to anybody that we have a major obesity epidemic, as well as an epidemic in diabetes. They are both directly related, and they are both getting worse. More than 35 million Americans have type 2 diabetes, over 10% of our population, 10% of our population, and about 90% of those with type 2 diabetes are obese. Diabetes is not only a serious illness unto itself, but it is a contributing factor to heart disease, stroke, amputations, blindness, and kidney failure. And the cost of treating these illnesses is staggering. According to the American Diabetes Association, the total cost of diabetes in the United States was nearly $413 billion. $413 billion, up 27% over the past 6 years. This amounts to about 10% of our total healthcare expenditures. That is an unbelievable and unsustainable amount of money. And when we talk about the type 2 diabetes epidemic and the huge increase in new cases, we must also talk about the epidemic of obesity in our country. Some 90% of people with type 2 diabetes are overweight or obese. These two epidemics go hand in hand. The time is long overdue for us to pose some very simple questions. How did it happen that, according to the CDC, the rate of childhood obesity in America has tripled since the 1970s and has gotten so bad that one out of every five children in our country is now obese? How has it happened that over 40% of adults in the United States today are obese? And in my view, the answers to these questions are not very complicated. For decades, Congress and the FDA have allowed large corporations to make huge profits by enticing children and adults to consume ultra-processed food and beverages loaded up with sugar, salt, and saturated fat. There is growing evidence that these foods are deliberately designed to be addictive, similar to cigarettes and alcohol, and lead to a higher rate of type 2 diabetes. Shockingly, according to a study published in the British Medical Journal, ultra-processed foods make up an incredible 73% of our nation's food supply. Bottom line, much of the food that we as Americans are now consuming are making us unhealthy and are contributing to the fact that our life expectancy is significantly lower than that of many other wealthy countries. None of this is happening by accident. The food and beverage industry is spending $14 billion a year on advertising to push these unhealthy products onto the American consumer. Even worse, and really unacceptable, $2 billion of this money is spent to directly advertise these unhealthy products to our children in order to get them hooked on these foods at an early age. According to the Rudd Center for Food Policy and Obesity, children and teens view about 4,000 food and beverage ads on television each year, an average of 10 advertisements per day. Last year, for example, Coca-Cola spent $327 million on advertising in the United States alone, while it raked in more than $9.5 billion in profits. Not one of these ads will tell you that a 20-ounce bottle of Coke contains more than 15 teaspoons of sugar, 15 teaspoons of sugar, over twice the recommended daily limit for kids. But one of these ads will tell you that drinking one can of Coke a day could increase your chance of getting type 2 diabetes by up to 26%. Given this reality, which has been widely discussed by scientists and doctors for decades, this really is not new news. The question then arises, what has the Food and Drug Administration, the FDA, done to address these epidemics which have impacted the health of millions of Americans and cost us hundreds of billions of dollars each year. As far as I can tell, the answer is not much. Way back in 2010, the National Academy of Medicine recommended that the food and beverage industry be required to put nutrition labels on the front of their products that the American people could easily understand. That was in 2010. On June 13th, 2023, the FDA announced that it would propose a rule to require the food and beverage industry to put nutrition labels on the front of their products no later than October of 2023. The FDA missed that deadline. On December 6, 2023, FDA announced that this proposed rule would be made public in June of 2024. The FDA missed that deadline. On July 5, 2024, the FDA announced that this proposed rule would be made public by October of 2024. The FDA missed that deadline. I have been told that on November 21st, 2024, after more than 14 years of inaction, the FDA finally sent this proposed rule to the Office of Management and Budget for their review, but it has still not been made public. That is unacceptable. In 2016, Chile implemented a law mandating warning labels on the front of unhealthy food and beverage products. After this law was implemented, calories consumed from these products went down by 24%. Similar labels were put into effect in Peru in 2019, in Israel and Mexico in 2020, in Uruguay in 2021, and in Brazil, Colombia, Argentina, and Venezuela from 2022 to 2024. Nearly 30 years ago, the FDA and Congress had the courage to take on a tobacco industry whose products killed over 400,000 Americans every year, including my father. And as a result of these actions, smoking rates among adults dropped from 43% in 1965 to 12% in 2023. Smoking rates among teens dropped even more significantly. That effort was a major success. Now is the time for us to seriously combat the type 2 diabetes and obesity epidemics in this country. In order to do that, we must have the courage to take on the greed of the food and beverage industry, which every day is undermining the health and well-being of our children. For starters, we need strong front-of-package food labels so that all consumers, especially children, can be warned as to which products are harmful to their health. Tobacco labels in the United States do not say high in tar, high in nicotine, high in carcinogens. They say cigarettes cause lung cancer, emphysema, and may complicate pregnancy. Not only must we put strong warning labels on unhealthy food and beverages, we must also ban junk food ads targeted to children. The National Institute of Health has estimated that if the United States banned fast food advertising marketed to children, we could cut the childhood obesity rate by 18%. And in my view, we have got to substantially reduce the outrageously high prices of diabetes and weight loss drugs for Ozempic and Wegovy.
Four native voting rights groups say exit poll data is misleading. Oregon State University and nine tribes open a facility to properly repatriate native remains. With these stories and much more, it's Brian Bull from Eugene, Oregon, with National Native News.
Four major Native American groups are criticizing the presentation of Native voters in exit polls for this year's presidential campaign. They say the data is misleading and potentially harmful. The groups say exit poll data from Edison Research for the National Election Pool is concerning. They say the sampling of 229 Native Americans does not reflect the diversity of Indian country, and add that exit polling was done at only 279 polling places on Election Day and 27 early in-person voting sites. None were held on tribal lands.
The numbers weren't quite adding up for us.
Michael Johnson is president of Illuminative. He says earlier work done with the Native Organizers Alliance on what's called the Indigenous Futures Survey showed different results from the Edison NEP research.
While 48% of our community aligned with liberal ideologies, 52% of our community considered themselves moderate conservative conservative or had no alignment to a party. And when we started seeing the exit poll data from Edison NEP, this didn't seem to square with some of the research we had done in our own community.
But many major news outlets went with Edison NEP's findings, which showed 34% of natives in key battleground states identifying as left-leaning and 65% as right-leaning. Johnson says this is inaccurate and harmful.
The pervasiveness of misinformation creates a bias towards things that we don't know or communities that we're not a part of, and adds to the stereotypes, biases, and miseducation, and stands in the way of solidarity for all of our communities.
The other two groups contesting the Edison Research NEP data are the Native American Rights Fund and the National Congress of American Indians. Edison Research tells National Native News that given factors like the small sample size and the potential sampling error, the survey data should not be taken as a definitive word on the American Indian vote. The proper repatriation of Native American remains is behind a new facility in Corvallis, Oregon. It's a collaboration between Oregon State University and the 9 federally recognized tribes within the state. Called the OSU NAGPRA facility, the two buildings are about 2,000 square feet total. They're for consultation, records, and storing human remains in accordance with the Native American Graves Protection and Repatriation Act. The 1990 federal law mandates the safe return of skeletons, bones, and cultural items to their tribes. Ashley Russell is Director of Natural Resources and Culture for the Confederated Tribes of Coos, Lower Umpqua, and Siuslaw Indians. She credits sensitive discussions among tribes, OSU, and the state in making this facility possible.
It's just very important to us as tribes to have that relationship and it not be a transactional thing, because these are ancestors. They've made their journey. They're on the other side, and you have to be careful when you navigate those sorts of things.
OSU's NAGPRA director, Don Marie Alapisco, was pleased with the support.
This is a change, a shift in how NAGPRA can and should be performed.
NAGPRA compliance has been a constant sore spot between many tribes and institutions. Some universities have retained bones and remains in years past, citing research needs. I'm Brian Bull in the KLCC studios of Eugene, Oregon.
You're listening to an end-of-year membership drive special of the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer production.